Okay, perfect. All right. This is Carson Backus interviewing Roberta Walburn on February 20th, 2023 for the Minnesota Historical Society Tobacco Control Oral History Project. We are meeting today at the 3C Conlin Law Firm in downtown Minneapolis. Roberta, thank you again so much for agreeing to speak with me today. I'm very, very excited about this.
Well, thanks, Carson, for your interest.
Of course. Could you just begin, please, by stating and spelling your full name?
Roberta, R-O-B-E-R-T-A, Walburn, W-A-L-B-U-R-N.
Thank you. Thought we'd start off easy.
Yep.
All right, and then can you please tell me where and when you were born?
Yeah, I was born in New York City in 1952.
Okay. And then could you tell me a little bit about your family growing up?
Yeah, so I was born in the city, but pretty much grew up in northeastern New Jersey,
okay.
Kind of a bedroom suburb of New York.
Okay.
And I have two sisters. And my mother was a journalist turned English teacher, high school English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was an accountant. No lawyers anywhere in my family.
Okay.
And we moved to Buffalo, New York when I was in high school. And I went to college at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. went back to Buffalo for a couple years to work on the Buffalo Evening News after college. And then came to Minnesota in 1977 for a job on the then Minneapolis Tribune as a reporter.
Gotcha, okay. Was there anything that brought you to Minneapolis specifically, or was it just the job was available and you...
Well, at that time, the Minneapolis Tribune had a phenomenal reputation.
Okay.
And the reporter who sat next to me at the Buffalo Evening News, his dream job was the Minneapolis Tribune.
Was it really?
Yeah, he used to talk about it all the time. So
oh my God.
That got my interest, and I kind of followed it. And then I was doing a lot of running back then.
Okay.
And the people I ran with thought that it was really cool to run in sub-zero weather, so they liked Minneapolis, too. Anyway, it seemed like a nice place, and they gave me a job.
Perfect. And then around what time did you kind of shift from reporting more into lawyer?
So I worked for a couple years on the Tribune.
Okay.
And I was stationed in St. Cloud for 2 years.
Okay.
I was the one person... St. Cloud Bureau, covering everything from St. Cloud to Bemidji, so kind of the third of the state. And
gotcha.
St. Cloud was a lonely outpost, but the reporting was great.
Really? Okay.
So, and there were a bunch of stories that had legal connotations during that time.
Okay.
The Wilmer 8 bank strike, which you're too young to remember, but it was eight women working at the bank in Wilmer.
Yes, that sounds very familiar
went
now.
Went on strike because they kept promoting men over. And then the other really big story when I was out there was they were building a high-voltage power line across Minnesota.
Okay.
And the farmers were protesting and, running their surveyors off their land with their snowmobiles and even tearing down some towers and stuff. And
yeah.
They're, like... dozens and dozens of farmers were getting arrested, so there was a lot of legal proceedings.
Okay.
As a quick aside, that's where I met Paul Wellstone, because he was out there
gotcha.
Organizing, helping to organize the farmers.
Okay.
And anyway, so there were a lot of, I interacted with a lot of lawyers, some of whom were like so understanding and explaining in layman's terms what was going on, and some of them were really snotty. And so I thought... If I got a law degree, I would understand more. It would help my journalism. I didn't go to law school to become a lawyer. I went to enhance my journalism career.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
So after 3 years working full-time on the Tribune, I started law school at the University of Minnesota. So I was going to law school during the day and working as a part-time police reporter nights and weekends.
Oh, okay. And then how soon was it after you finished your degree that you decided to leave reporting?
So, around my second year of law school, one of my reporter colleagues thought that I would hit it off with Judge Miles Lord, who was then the chief federal judge in Minnesota and quite a character, kind of a prairie populist. So the reporter and I and Miles went out to lunch, and kind of the next thing I knew, Miles was offering me a clerkship for when I graduated, a one-year clerkship. And I thought, I still was going to stay in journalism, but I thought, I mean, Miles was a living legend. I actually wrote a book about him.
Really?
Yeah, I can give you a copy before you leave.
Cool. But,
yeah, he was something else. So I decided I could always go back to journalism, but clerking for Miles Lord would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which it was. And so while I was clerking for Judge Lord, he took on the biggest case in the country, which was the Dalkon Shield IUD litigation.
Okay.
It was women who were injured by an IUD, the Dalkon Shield. Some of them lost their fertility. Some of them had these horrible infections. Some of them died. It was a massive case, thousands of women suing. He took on those cases while I was clerking for him. One of the lead attorneys for the women was Mike Cerisi. So that's where my paths crossed with Mike.
Okay.
And just watching Mike and his team in action in the courtroom, when you clerk for a judge, you see a lot because it's like a 10-year, you condense 10 years of practice into 1 year because you just see different lawyers in different cases every day, and you see different styles and what works and what doesn't, and Mike and the lawyers working with him were the best lawyers I'd seen, and I loved the enthusiasm and passion they brought to their case, and they were the best lawyers I'd seen in the courtroom, and I liked the fact that they were going toe-to-toe with a huge corporation. The manufacturer at the time was one of the largest corporations in the country.
Okay.
So when my clerkship was done, I went to work at then, I guess the firm was called Robin Zell Larson and Kaplan at the time, where Mike was.
Gotcha, okay. Did you ever regret not going back into journalism at all?
I mean, I missed it. There's nothing like a newsroom, especially when you're young. But, I was so fortunate in my law career in both the kinds of cases that I got to do and the people I was working with. And I think my writing developed better when I was a lawyer because I didn't, because you have more space to work with, newspaper. The thing that frustrated me as a reporter and why I thought a law degree would help my journalism was, as a reporter, you're just doing the same story, and you got like 8 hours to do a story, and then the next day it's another story. And, when you write your 10th snowstorm of the century story, it's repetitive. So I wanted to do more enterprise reporting where I got more time and more space.
Okay.
But as a lawyer, I got to really, the cases that I worked on with, tobacco being the prime example, I got to concentrate on one big case for years at a time, and then the writing that went with it, like my signature brief as a lawyer is writing this incredible fact section so that by the time you get to, so a brief is typically you start with a statement of facts, you write your facts, and then you do your legal argument.
Okay.
So a lot of lawyers, they rush through the statement of facts because they think everything's in the legal argument.
Uh-huh.
My view is in most cases,
okay,
by the time a judge is done reading the statement of facts, he or she should know what the outcome is.
Fair enough.
And
wow.
So,
okay.
And so I got to, develop my writing with lots of space to write statements of fact.
Okay. And a kind of similar question maybe, but how did your career as a journalist then inform your career as a lawyer? What skills did you use that were the same?
Yeah, so a lot of the skills were transferable.
Okay.
And I felt like sometimes even gave me an unfair advantage. Because, for one thing, and Mike and I shared this philosophy, was fax drive cases. So not just writing your brief, but fax and discovery, which when we get to the tobacco litigation, mm-hmm. you know, that's the ultimate. But so really, really developing the facts and trying to find out what happened. And, you know, in a lawsuit, you have more tools to use okay. to get, you know, as a reporter, if someone slams the door in your face, I mean, that's basically it. You can do a FOIA request, but that's got a lot of limitations. So, so doing that, writing, obviously, and then just being able to work fast. So a lot of lawyers are kind of plotting, no offense to all the lawyers out there, but being able to work fast and being able to kind of get to the heart of what matters, you know, without getting lost in the forest.
Okay. I'm sure you have so many stories from your time with Cersei before the tobacco trial began, but what were a few of the highlights maybe of your time there?
So I went to work at the law firm in January of 85.
Okay.
And within a couple of weeks, I was on a plane to India with Mike because we ended up representing the government of India in the Bhopal gas leak disaster litigation,
okay. mm-hmm.
which was the biggest industrial disaster in the history of the planet. And so for the next, I guess, year and a half, we were, you know, going back and forth to India, which was an incredible experience. But also, Mike and I bonded during that period, obviously. There were a couple other people traveling with us, but it was, you know, an intense way to get an introduction to a legal practice.
Fair enough. Forwarding a little bit then, what made you decide to take on the lawsuit against the tobacco industry?
So we started thinking about it in 1998 or 99,
mm-hmm.
so 5 or so years before we actually filed suit.
Okay.
We had just wrapped up litigation involving another IUD, the Copper 7 IUD, representing women.
Okay.
And so in a case like that, the firm is representing more than 100 women, and we had a couple trials that lasted 3 or 4 months with 100 more cases and potential trials like left to go.
Oh my gosh.
So you're looking at the future and that's all you see for years out there. And then one day you wake up and the case is all settled and all of a sudden, and that's how, you know, that kind of litigation tends to go. So all of a sudden we had, you know, time to think about what we wanted to do.
Okay.
And we started to think of what's the biggest challenge out there, and we started to think about tobacco. At that time, there had been 35 years or so of litigation against the industry.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the early 1950s, and no plaintiff had ever won one penny. And then at the same time, in that period in the 1980s, there was a phenomenal attorney in New Jersey named Mark Adell, who was making some progress in the tobacco litigation representing individual smokers. And he started to do, to our knowledge, the first substantive discovery of the tobacco industry documents.
Okay.
And it was intriguing what he was finding. So we decided that we would do a study or due diligence and see if we wanted to do that case.
Okay.
And we did an on and off for the next 5 years or so. So we were doing other things, other cases in the meantime. I left the firm for a year to mm-hmm. work for Paul Wellstone.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like we were doing it full time, but we did a lot of work before we decided to file.
Why do you think you and Mike Cersei were the only ones that wanted to, like you said, you wanted the biggest challenge out there? Why were you the ones, I guess, like why wasn't anybody else asking that question and just looking into the tobacco industry? What, were there people doing that at the time, or was it just you?
I think there were probably a few people around the country doing it,
okay,
but not the way we were doing it. I think we just delved into it in more depth.
Okay.
Since I never had a dream of being a lawyer anyway,
mm-hmm.
I didn't care if I wasn't following the traditional lawyer path.
Okay.
So, you know, when I started, just like to go back a little bit, when I started at the law firm, like other associates in my, you know, experience level would belittle the work I was doing because I wasn't doing the traditional, you know, take a deposition, you know, argue a motion.
Okay.
But I'm like, oh yeah, but I'm going to India every month. So. But I didn't care because it didn't matter to me. Okay. If I didn't like it at the law firm, I was going to go back to journalism. So I didn't really care. So when the opportunity came to look into tobacco again, I didn't care that I wasn't being the most productive lawyer during that period of time.
Uh-huh.
I was doing a lot of work that we weren't getting paid for. Other people would worry about that, but I didn't really care.
Okay.
And then Mike, you know, always had this big vision, and so we were a good team.
Can you describe what was the actual work that you were doing now when you were investigating tobacco at this period? Like,
yeah,
what went to that?
So, for starters, I just, you know, there was 35, 40 years of litigation history,
mm-hmm.
So I started gathering pleadings and materials from other cases around the country and reading as much as I could about the litigation. Really immersing myself in it. And then talking to some of the lawyers who had been involved, including going out to New Jersey a couple times to meet with Mark Adele.
Okay.
And just talking to him about his experience and getting more pleadings and information on the case to read. And it quickly became apparent that, so up until this time, every case had been filed by an individual smoker or their family, so a smoker who had gotten lung cancer or died, and they sued the tobacco industry. And it quickly became apparent that we would have to find a different model, you know, because what's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result? So, you know, as part of the research, you know, I was seeing the extraordinary healthcare costs that smoking was causing. And so we started to fix on looking at a different kind of plane of being a state that paid a lot of healthcare costs or a healthcare provider. And then the challenge, so that came pretty early.
Okay.
But then the challenge became, what are your causes of action? Because it's not a typical personal injury case. There had never really been a case that we were aware of that was framed like this. Now they're more common, these healthcare recovery costs, but back then they weren't. And so we did a lot of research looking at the laws in all 50 states to see what their statutes and laws were. And as it turned out, Minnesota had, you know, as good a legal framework as any state.
Okay.
So we started thinking about suing in Minnesota. And the facts and the legal theories that we started to gravitate to. So one would be the three big changes from how we were going to frame the case were going to be, one, who were the plaintiffs? The state and Blue Cross.
Okay.
Two, instead of focusing on the product,
mm-hmm.
cigarettes, the cigarette kills when used as intended, but it's a legal product, we were going to focus on the conduct of the industry.
Okay.
So, and that would be, you know, starting with the big lie. At that time, they were still not admitting that smoking caused cancer or any other disease and was addictive. And then the third thing that we focused on for making the case different was, how are we going to prove their conduct?
Mm-hmm.
And that was through document discovery. So we met We knew that the AG's office under Skip had some attorneys that were doing a lot of work in tobacco control efforts, including Doug Bonnke and Tom Purcell.
Sure.
And so we started meeting with them, and they were pretty excited. And then Blue Cross was sort of kind of a happenstance. So one day in this five-year period, an in-house attorney at Blue Cross, Tom Gildy, G-I-L-D-E.
Thank you.
Was a blind call to our office saying, so a lot of healthcare providers do subrogation cases. So if there's like a big mass tort, the plaintiffs recover for their personal injuries, but then the healthcare providers come in and recover their healthcare costs.
Okay.
So Tom was interested just in talking to someone in our mass tort department about what big mass torts we might see on the horizon.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, we were having a pretty good conversation, so I thought I'd test out tobacco. So I said, well, what about tobacco? And instead of running for the door, his eyes lit up. And it turned out that, you know, Blue Cross, their CEO at the time was Andy Jachowski. I don't know how to spell it.
No worries.
And a couple other people, Dick Nemec and their general counsel, Chap Millis. Anyway, they turned out to be a great group of people, and so that was the partnership that was formed.
Okay. And then at what point did you start getting some pushback from all of this?
Well, at the law firm, wasn't exactly the most popular idea.
Okay.
I think when I first made partner, Mike at my first partners meeting had me stand up and talk about prospective tobacco litigation, and it was like people were going,
Okay.
So, I mean, some people were excited, and some people just thought it was a fool's errand.
Okay. Were they worried about like their
financial? Because we were going to do it essentially on a contingency fee basis. But Mike, I can't remember when he became chairman of the firm, but at some point he became chairman of the firm, and he was on the executive board anyway all through this period. He was just adamant that we were going to do this. And I was insulated from a lot of the pushback.
Okay.
I just did my thing, so I tried to stay out of firm politics. At the AG's office and Blue Cross, I mean, they were very enthusiastic, so.
Then, so can you remind me of the timeline here with the settlement talk that was happening? Was that around the same time, or was that?
That was a little later. So we filed in, I think, August of 1994.
Gotcha.
And the settlement talk was probably a couple of years down the road.
Okay.
After a bunch of other states started suing.
Can you describe a little bit of Skip's participation in all of this?
Yeah, so, I mean, you can't say enough about Skip Humphrey and his leadership role in this. First to have the courage to take it on. He also shared our vision, which was this case is not just about the money. It's about shining the light on the industry conduct, and that would come through the document discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what kind of pushback he got when we first filed. I mean, other people like Doug could tell you more about that.
Sure.
But when, you know, eventually the majority of states filed kind of copycat lawsuits. But we felt that we were the only state that was treating this like an actual lawsuit where you, like, prepare for trial.
Fair enough.
Bring motions and you do document discovery. And other states were filing and then waiting for a settlement, right? So when the settlement talk did start, almost every other state wanted to take the money and run. And Skip Humphrey, who, you know, had been in the Attorney General for a long time at that point, and who was, you know, these were his, you know, buddies around the country. He stood almost alone in opposing the settlement, and they couldn't do a settlement unless they got unanimous. The tobacco industry wouldn't settle unless they had everyone on board. I think there were only maybe two other attorney generals who stood by Skip. And so he had, you know, displayed enormous courage and fortitude in standing up to his colleagues, essentially, who were, you know, with billions of dollars on the table, and saying, no, we're not going to settle until we get the documents, and the documents are public. It wasn't money that was the holdup. It was one of the main purposes of the case was to uncover the truth.
Why would you say, why was there this flood of copycat cases, you said, from the other states?
Money.
Okay. Did they see the work you were doing, and were they inspired by that, or was it their own?
Most of the states I had no idea, but so our main, the states that were the most supportive of us were Connecticut, Wisconsin, and I think Maryland to a certain degree.
Okay.
The state that was our main adversary was Mississippi. So their attorney general was Mike Moore.
Yeah.
And his lead outside counsel was Dickie Scruggs. And, you know, so I was at, again, I was insulated from a lot of this, but I was at a couple of meetings when they flew in, I believe, Dickie Scruggs' private plane up to St. Paul to meet with Skip, and we went to a couple of those meetings, and where they were trying to convince us to settle. They knew the document discovery we were doing, and they thought we were wasting our time. They were kind of making fun of it. You know, at the beginning, so we did, you know, 3.5 years of document discovery. At the beginning, nobody knew what was going on. At the beginning, it was a really slow go for ourselves as well. So it was kind of a leap of faith that we were going to hit the jackpot. So the other states, and I mean, the document discovery was a huge part of the work, but the other huge part of the work was framing our legal theories, which again were a little bit creative, although they were founded in, you know, hard rock Minnesota law, but they were still being used in a different way. So there was a lot of briefing and work on the legal theories as well. So most of the other states were content just to adopt our legal theories. And then when we get into more of the documents, like when we were getting millions of pages of documents, not only was no one coming, not only were people not like doing their own discovery for the most part in other states, but they weren't even willing to go through the documents. Like going through 35 million pages of documents was a lot of work, but getting the documents was more work. And again, almost, I think there were only maybe two states that sent a couple of attorneys every once in a while to help us review them.
Wow.
And instead, what these other states did was, so when we, and I'll talk about this more in detail, but when we used to go to the document depository down on Hennepin and review the documents, we selected, it ended up being 1-2% of the documents to copy and bring back to our office for further analysis.
Okay.
And that became known, that 1-2% became known as the Minnesota Select Set. So these other states, instead of doing their own discovery, would say, we just want the Minnesota Select Set.
Gotcha, okay.
And then they would get mad at us when we wouldn't settle. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay, I kind of answered my next question already, I think. All right, yeah, and then fast forwarding maybe a little bit to the documents. Is there anything that I've, like, major I've missed leading up to this, do you think?
No, I think, yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Can you talk about some of the key strategies, then, that the tobacco industry used to avoid producing all these documents you were
yeah.
after?
So in that 5-year due diligence period before we sued, you know, I'd be reading these pleadings from other cases, and I'd see that other attorneys were serving document requests, so that's how you start.
Okay.
That's how you start the effort to get documents is you serve the other party with a list of the, by categories of the documents. And like, I would see that they were serving document requests and there'd be some like litigation and motions over documents. And then like the trail would just end. And I was like, well, this is odd. And I mean, it just turned out that their way of litigating is just to stall and obstruct and wear you out. And if you're just representing a single plaintiff, a single injured person, mm-hmm. you probably don't have the resources to fight that.
Yeah.
So that was, and that was one way. And then, you know, some of, I mean, they just like hit you with massive numbers of people and resources. So in the Minnesota case, just in our state alone, there were more than 35 law firms representing the tobacco companies, most of them from out of state. You know, we had one law firm. Philip Morris alone was said in court one day that they were spending $1.2 million each week just on the tobacco litigation. So, I mean, we had like a core team of about 10 lawyers. So, yeah, you're outnumbered and they're objecting to everything. And then they play word games. So, like in your document requests, when we served our first round of document requests, there's probably about 100 different categories.
Okay.
You know, give us your documents on smoking causing cancer, give us your documents on addiction, give us your, you know, documents on document destruction. So we had 100 some request categories, and we didn't get a single document back in response to that.
Wow.
Instead, we got, you know, a mound of paper of objections. So then, and some of their objections are, we don't understand the words that you're using. So they didn't understand what the words smoking and health meant. They didn't understand what the words safer cigarettes meant. They didn't understand what addictive meant. They didn't understand what document destruction policies are. So just like mountains of objections. So before you can bring a motion, in most courts you have to go to a meet and confer with the other side to see if you can work out your differences. Yeah, right? So we used to go to these meet and confers, and it was mostly, at these meet and confers, it was mostly myself and Susan Richard Nelson,
okay.
Who's now a federal judge in St. Paul. So we would go to these meet and confers for the plaintiffs, because her part of the case was producing the documents for the state,
okay.
and Blue Cross, so they were serving their own document requests on us.
Okay.
And defending that part of the case. So Susan and I would go to these meetings, and there'd be, you know, a couple dozen tobacco lawyers, you know, maybe 30, all men. So in four years of litigation, I only remember ever seeing two women for the tobacco companies. It was just all men. So,
wow.
And so we would go and we'd sit around these rooms and they'd say, yeah, we don't know what you mean by, you know, this word or that word. So then we would, so that's one way they did it. And then they claimed privilege on a lot of documents.
Mm-hmm.
So even like scientific research, so they would say it's attorney-client privilege, we're not producing it. And privilege is really hard to break. And in addition, certain types of documents and research were done or shipped overseas, which mm-hmm. legally should not make a difference, but practically it did. So they had like multiple strategies for not producing things. So at the first meet and confer, I think what they said is, we'll give you all the documents that have been produced in other litigation. Is that, like, would that satisfy you? But no.
No, not. No. And what were the practical reasons that shipping documents overseas wasn't helpful?
Well, because it doesn't matter where a document's located. If it's a Philip Morris
yeah.
document, it's Philip Morris has control over
okay.
it. So, yeah.
Okay.
But in conjunction with the overseas, they would have like different corporate subsidiaries that
mm-hmm.
would make it like doubly hard to figure out okay. like who has control over the documents.
Gotcha. Okay. How did you end up breaking the privilege?
So I'm going to take the long route to
Please.
Answering that. But because, as I said, like breaking privilege is really hard. The only case I've ever done it in all my years as a lawyer is the tobacco case. Because
okay.
lawyers write the rules, and so they protect their own stuff. So in privilege, breaking privilege, in a case like this, timing is everything. So if we had moved too early, we didn't think we'd be successful. So we knew we were going to go after the privilege documents, but we knew we wanted to build a foundation for getting them. So at one of our first meetings with the tobacco companies, Mike was at that meeting conferring, and he said to the tobacco company lawyers, we're going to be coming after your privilege document, guys, just so you know it. We're going to be coming after them, and the words he used were like bees to honey. So just like put them aside in a room because we're going to get to that later. So, but we built our strategy. So, we knew from the start that document discovery was going to be one of the keys to the case. And so, in our team meetings early on, we would strategize. So, we knew the document requests would be key. Mark Adele, when we met with him in New Jersey, mm-hmm. told us that it was really important to get a document depository
okay.
for the documents because he didn't have one. And he said, so he would go to review the documents, and he got about 1 million pages of documents. He would go to the defense lawyers' offices to review the documents,
mm-hmm.
and they would bring in like 4 boxes, and he'd review them, and then they'd take those away. And he said, like, he couldn't keep track of, like, are they bringing out new documents? Is
exactly.
this the same? He said, you need a depository with a third party to administer it so that there's some integrity to the collection. So we asked the court to establish a document depository, and we ended up having 2, one down Hennepin Avenue, mm-hmm. Which is just closing now, right?
Yeah.
And then one in Guildford, England,
yeah.
For the British American Tobacco document. So we knew that, and we knew we were just, going to have to be persistent. So, we just started the meet and confers, bringing motions to compel. We had standard monthly hearings in front of Judge Fitzpatrick, who was amazing, who did really unbelievable work on the case. So monthly hearings, and we would, we could have brought like 100 motions to compel in every month, mm-hmm. but we would like try and narrow it down to the top most important 10. So we would just start chipping away a little bit. And then one of the big things we did was, have you heard about the 4A indexes?
I've heard of it. Yes, I think so.
Okay, so when we were just sitting around as a team, like strategizing mm-hmm. how we were going to get these documents, we thought, okay, this industry's been in constant litigation since the early 1950s. They've hardly produced any documents. Mm-hmm. They got all these law firms around the country.
Mm-hmm.
What have they been doing? And then around the time we were filing, a former legal assistant for one of the companies, Merrill Williams, yeah, so he had been a legal assistant working at Brown & Williamson, reviewing documents, categorizing mm-hmm. them and stuff, and then he like stole a few thousand documents, like put them under his shirt or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that they were like collecting the documents
okay.
and doing something with them. We said, well, what would you do if you were the tobacco companies and you had all these lawyers and unlimited amounts of money? Well, you would index the documents, right?
Uh-huh.
So in one of the very first motions in front of Judge Fitzpatrick, we asked him to order them to produce their existing document indexes. So in the case management order, which was one of the first orders in the case, he issued an order saying the tobacco companies have to produce their existing document indexes.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the order. I called up. So the lead counsel for the tobacco companies were the attorneys representing Philip Morris, because they were the biggest player in the industry, so they were the lead counsel. So their lead counsel at that time was out in California. So I called him up and said, yeah, we want your document indexes. And he said, we don't have any. And I'm like, that doesn't sound right. But, you know, you can't, I had learned my lesson on another case when I was a younger lawyer, like, uh-huh. You can't go to a court and say, I think he's lying. Like, you need proof.
Okay.
So I can't just go to the court and say, says he doesn't have any, but I don't believe him. So, like, every week, I would call him up and say, where are your document indexes? And he would say, you know, you're sounding like a broken record. Like, he'd make fun of me. We don't have any, blah, 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 blah. So this went on for, I think, a couple months. And then one day, we were at a small meet and confer. I forget what the reason was. It wasn't about this. And Mike was there and I was there. There were maybe just 10 tobacco company lawyers, which was, like, not even a quorum for them. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll use this opportunity to ask again. So I asked, said, where are the document indexes? And one of the lawyers said, well, we don't have any. But then one of the lawyers sitting, like, in the second row started to smirk. And to this day, like, Mike and I just think, well, why did he do this? So I said, well, what's so funny? And he said, well, we don't have indexes. We have databases. So it, like, that goes back to what I was talking about earlier about playing word games. They don't understand what you're asking for. Like, well, what's an index? We don't know what an index is. So now we had something to go back to the court with. So we said, you know, so the judge issued a second order saying, produce the databases. And now the industry said, well, we can't produce them because they're privileged or work product.
Perfect.
So we said, we brought another motion saying, well, produce them for the in-camera review, for the court to review in-camera. And now they said they were too voluminous to produce in camera. So they go from, like, they don't exist to they're so voluminous that we can't produce them in camera. In fact, R.J. Reynolds said, just one company said it spent $90 million on its indexes, 90. So now the judge is getting into it, because by the end, we had 8 orders from the trial court, and then an appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, Minnesota Supreme Court, and U.S. Supreme Court. It took 16 months to get before this was done. But now the judge is getting into it, and so we issued an order someplace like in the middle of this odyssey that said he divided it into 2 types of indexes. The 4A indexes were these indexes created by attorneys before our litigation.
Okay.
And then the 4B indexes were every party had to index the documents they were producing in this litigation. So that's how it got the name 4A indexes.
Okay.
So So now the judge said, well, produce random samples of your indexes.
Oh, okay.
And he went through them, and when I, you know, said that Judge Fitzpatrick did an amazing job, it wasn't because he was, like, ruling in our favor all the time. He worked really hard, and he created a great record. And so an example of that is he went through these indexes, and some companies had multiple indexes, and they had, like, different fields of information. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want their subjective attorney comments on the, like, this document really hurts us. Or, we just wanted the objective information. What's the date of it? Who's the author? Who's the recipient?
Okay.
What's the title? That kind of thing.
Okay.
That's all we wanted. And so he went through meticulous detail and said, these are the fields of information. You know, we didn't know what to ask for because we didn't have the indexes.
Exactly.
He went through and said, these are the objective fields of information that that the plaintiffs can get, and then they appealed that order. And when, like, by the time we got the indexes, which was after 16 months of litigation, but probably about 2 years into the case, by this point, people were starting to pay attention to the Minnesota litigation. And in fact, when the document indexes were ordered, produced to us, I think was Clinton the president? I think Clinton was president at the time. And he, like, said this, he issued a statement on the document and said, this is the roadmap to the tobacco company documents. And it, I mean, it was an invaluable tool, but we were getting documents using other strategies as well. But with the indexes, the indexes, like, we could run searches of, like, by this point in time, we were, the documents didn't come all, the 35 million pages of documents didn't come all in at once. Like, it was a rolling production. In fact, it continued all the way through trial. So by this point, like, We're reviewed. So we had a team of about six core document reviewers.
Okay.
Who would go to the depository every day. They were all partners except for one associate, which is not a normal law firm strategy. Usually they have the younger lawyers.
Yeah.
But in our, so we were, like, our team was kind of the renegades of the law firm that didn't necessarily, not everybody, but didn't necessarily fit in with the rest of the law firm.
Okay.
And so for us, like, on this case, you know, reviewing documents was the highest calling. So, so they were going, the team would go there, flag the documents. I would read all the documents that they brought back.
Okay.
So I had a sense of the whole. Every Friday afternoon, we had a team document meeting to talk about what we were finding in the depository, to kind of try and keep on the same page, because you can get lost in all this paper. We had to keep our focus on, we're going to go to trial with this case, and we need to figure out what documents are going to support our claims.
Okay.
And so we would talk about it, and then we would have a document of the week contest where each attorney would, like, put in their entry for a dollar per entry and argue why their document was the best document found that week. And it was, and then we would take the pool of money and go out and get beers afterwards. But it was the best way to, like, keep everyone on the same page.
Absolutely.
And, like, because when you're arguing, for people got really, like, passionate about their document being the best, and we would argue about why it was great and why another document was better. So, you know, by this point, when we were getting the indexes, we knew, you know, we were starting to learn about who the key players were at the companies and what key dates were and key terms. And then you'd send out more document requests. Like, if you find, you know, a key scientist, you'd send out a document request saying we want all their files.
Okay.
It's just kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion. And, you know, the documents weren't produced in any kind of order. They were just, like, thrown into boxes, like, just a mishmash of stuff. Like, attachments weren't attached to the documents.
Oh,
like, there was a lot of junk in there, like tobacco beetle documents, like the insect. I mean, it was just, like, a mess. But, like, little by little, you start to, like, figure out what's going on. And then you get the document indexes in, so you can now search yourself, like, okay, what did this scientist write, you know, and who was copied on this, what happened around the state, and then find out the terms they were using. So, like, we weren't getting a lot of documents about targeting kids, you know, in marketing.
Sure.
And then when we got the document indexes, we found out that they didn't call them kids or underage, they called them young adults. So now we could ask for documents about young adults. So it's just, like, this constant, like, learning and chipping away at the defenses and building the case. And then, so eventually, and so during this time, so we had a protective order, so we couldn't release our documents to the public.
Okay.
Except, the exception was, if you attached a document to a motion, it became public. And so when we were bringing our motions to compel, like, we had to tell the judge why we think this person's so important, because this document. So a couple reporters in the Twin Cities, and then there was a great reporter in Los Angeles who was following this case closely. So they knew, they would just, like, start getting our motions and our documents and start to write about it. So people around the country were gradually coming to understand what was going on in Minnesota. And so eventually, I think, when do we start moving on privilege? Probably, I don't know, at least 2.5 or 3 years into the litigation, we started to move on privilege.
Okay.
And so the two bases, and so we were going to use the documents that we had to break privilege.
Gotcha.
So we had two bases for breaking privilege. One was that the documents weren't privileged in the first instance. So they were doing scientific research, but they would have an attorney copied on it and then claim it was privileged. Well, just like copying an attorney on a scientific study doesn't make it privileged. And so they wanted to keep it secret because, like, their big lie was, so you know, going back to the 1950s, mm-hmm. The reason the litigation started in the 1950s was that was the time when the first hard scientific evidence on smoking causing lung cancer became public. And it was a combination of epidemiological studies and mouse back painting studies where they took the cigarette tar condensate from cigarettes and painted it on the backs, shaved backs of mice and tumors grew. So it caused a nationwide sensation and scare. And if you read the documents from the early 1950s, the industry thought they were done. I mean, this was like an existential threat to the industry. And the heads of the major tobacco companies gathered, I think in the Plaza Hotel in New York City in 1954 to talk about how they were going to meet this threat. And that's when, in our theory of the case, the big conspiracy and the big lie began. So instead of admitting cigarettes cause cancer, they banded together, told the public they were going to research and get to the bottom of this. But instead, either didn't undertake the research or undertook the research and hid it under claims of privilege or sending it abroad or doing the research abroad. And then telling the public, reassuringly, it's not proven that smoking causes any disease. So that was the big lie. That was the big conspiracy.
And that's what the firm statement.
The Frank statement?
Frank statement. Exactly. Yeah.
So, which I have here. Cool. So, so that was the Frank statement. So that was like, that was the kickoff of our conspiracy big lie theory. And so when we were moving on privilege, you know, we were seeing evidence that the lawyers were controlling the scientific research, and so that if they had research that was harmful to the industry, it wouldn't be disclosed. So first basis for breaking privilege was it's not privileged material. It's science. And then the second basis is there's a crime fraud exception to the privilege.
And remind me what crime fraud means.
Yeah, so crime fraud means the privilege, even if a document is privileged, it loses its privilege if the attorney is counseling the client on an ongoing or future crime or fraud.
Okay.
So it's like if a client comes to you and said, I killed this guy yesterday, tells the attorney that, that's a privileged communication because it happened in the past. But if the client says, I'm going to kill this guy tomorrow, So it's the crime fraud exception.
Okay.
In fact, it's been in the news in the last couple of weeks with some of the investigations into Trump.
Okay.
Pay attention to that. So anyway, those were the two bases we moved on privilege, and we had a lot of documents that we'd already gotten that were in privilege that would support that. And so we went through multiple hearings on privilege, and Judge Fitzpatrick appointed a special master, a private attorney from St. Paul, Mark Guillen, to oversee it because it became so much work. And we didn't get the full load of privilege documents until a couple months into trial, when the tobacco companies appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court was denied.
Okay. Is that, I keep seeing the number 39,000 around. Mm-hmm. That was the 39,000 pages that were released? Okay.
Yeah.
What was it like? How did you feel when you saw that that claim was going to be upheld? Like, what was going through your mind then?
Well, it happens like in a, you know, piecemeal way.
Okay, so not like one huge euphoric moment.
Yeah, and I mean, by the time like the last appeal was denied the Supreme Court, I mean, we were in trial. I mean, we were prepared to go all the way through trial without those documents.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was a big deal, but there was a lot going on.
Okay.
So.
How is your throat feeling? Do you want to take a break at all?
I'm okay. Are you, do you want to take a break?
I'm good.
Okay.
Cool. Okay. And were you being sequestered during all of this? You were staying at the St. Paul Hotel.
Oh, during trial.
During trial. Okay, it's not this time.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
Pre-trial, we weren't sequestered, but the tobacco team, we took over a corner of one of the floors, devoted one big office. We called it the Bat Cave, and that's where we did most of our document review.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then maybe heading into the trial a little bit, if that's okay. Can you start by talking a little bit about like the atmosphere in the courtroom? Because you were in the courtroom for parts of it, right?
Or the whole thing.
The whole thing, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, we had about our trial team of lawyers and six lawyers and a couple paralegals moved into a floor of the St. Paul Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
The tobacco company's lawyers had a different floor of the hotel.
Okay.
We stationed an off-duty St. Paul police officer like at the elevators of our floor, so control. We had the room swept for bugs randomly. We wouldn't even know when they were going to do it. So Judge Fitzpatrick was, you know, he was a great judge, but it was really frustrating for us for the first 2 or 3 years because he was very cautious and almost never spoke from the bench. So he was hard to read, very cautious, giving the tobacco companies every benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
We'd come back from those hearings, the monthly status hearings, at least I did, came back very frustrated because I thought it was really obvious that they were stalling.
Okay.
You know, when you have 1,000 legal professionals and they say they can only produce 10 boxes a month, that doesn't make sense to me. But, you know, and he never really said much, but sort of like how we were building our case step by step, you know, he was getting it, and he didn't, by the time, one of the reasons I like working on cases like tobacco, where you're doing one case for months or years at a time in front of a single judge, is that too many times judges, you know, cut the baby in the middle. So if the other side is making outrageous arguments, but you're playing it straight, you're losing because the judge is going to cut it in the middle over. And the middle is not the middle. The middle is...
Gotcha.
So, and I don't like making arguments that aren't real. So it can be frustrating at the beginning of a case because you're not getting what you want. But over time, judges learn who's being straight with them and who's not.
Okay.
And so by the time we got to trial, the judge was, you know, pretty much onto their gamesmanship.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things he did was he ran a really strict courtroom, so he needed a badge to get into the courtroom and sit there. If anybody was talking or... Mary Hurt, Richard's Hurt, our expert from the Mayo Clinic, Richard Hurt, his wife was chewing gum one day in court, and he kicked her out, I think. So it was, the courtroom was, you know, it was business-like. It was, you know, it was a strict courtroom, which is great.
Okay.
The tobacco companies had, each side had a war room in the courthouse.
Okay.
The tobacco companies, but not us, they had a live feed of the trial, so they could sit in their war room and watch. And like their lead lawyer would sit down in their war room watching. I'm like, you're not in the courtroom?
That's bizarre. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
I guess, yeah, maybe specifically, could you talk a little bit about Richard Hurt and his testimony? Because you used him to kind of get some of those documents out to the public. Right?
Yeah, well. So Richard Hurt was an addiction specialist from the Mayo Clinic. So early on, right within a couple months of us filing our case, you know, when we were looking, we wanted to get the best experts in the country. And it turned out one was in our backyard. So we met with Richard, and you know, the Mayo Clinic was not used to having its doctors be experts in any kind of case.
Okay.
They weren't thrilled with this, and Richard had never been an expert before, which is, there's pluses and minuses to having experts who've never testified before. If they've testified too much, you know, they look like they're just expert witnesses, you know,
exactly,
professional witnesses. But it's pretty scary having somebody who's never testified before in a case like this. And so Richard was really passionately against what the tobacco industry was doing. So he signed on, and we would, almost every month, we went down to the Mayo to meet with him, and he would teach us the science of addiction.
Okay.
And we would bring him documents from the depository that dealt with how the tobacco companies view addiction, including, and this was one of the revelations of our documents, mm-hmm, how they were manipulating the form of tobacco to optimize its addictive potential. So people, before our case, people, you think of tobacco, it's a, you know, agricultural product.
Mm-hmm.
They harvest it, they dry it, they roll it up into cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a news story or two right around the time we were filing, making allegations that the tobacco companies were manipulating the amount of nicotine,
okay,
in the cigarettes, which the companies were denying, but it turned out from our documents what they were doing was manipulating the form, and the pH of the nicotine to make it have a more immediate impact, which enhances its addictive potential. So we were bringing these documents to Richard, and he was like, nobody even knows about this. He was like, his mind was being blown by these documents.
Crazy.
I mean, he turned out to be just an amazing witness. And he was turned, we used him as our lead witness in the trial. So he was our first one. You should really interview him.
Yes, yes, he's on my list. I guess I'm going to skip this too. What were some of the other major takeaways from the documents that kind of floored you similarly to
nicotine? Well, so on the theme of the big lie,
mm-hmm,
you know, if you had to say, like, what are the top 10 documents from the case? So one of them was certainly called the 1958 Tripp Report.
Okay.
So in 1958, three scientists from British American Tobacco,
mm-hmm,
came to the United States to find out what the industry knew about the dangers of smoking.
Okay.
And they visited many of the U.S. tobacco companies. They went around the country, interviewed their scientists, and they went back and they wrote a report, which stayed hidden in their files until, you know, we discovered it decades later. And so what they said in that report was that essentially the industry knows that smoking causes lung cancer. And, like, the reason that was such a great document, and obviously one document of the week whenever that was discovered, was so it's old. It pushes the big lie all the way back into the 1950s.
Gotcha.
Like, they know it causes lung cancer, but they're still denying it, like, 40 years later. And it, like, the other thing that made it a great document was it linked all of the, or most of the tobacco companies together, so it wasn't just like one company. So
okay,
it was like an early, early indication that of the industry-wide conspiracy. So there were a bunch of documents like that over the years where internally they're admitting causation.
Okay.
And then similarly, there were documents about addiction,
mm-hmm,
not going back that far, but about the addictive potential.
Okay.
And marketing to underage kids.
Young adults.
Young adults, yep. And manipulating the form of the nicotine. I think those are some of the big categories.
Then, I guess anything else about the trial we should talk about, really? I know there's, obviously so much to it.
Yeah.
Are there any other stories you have that you'd like to share specifically about the trial?
Yeah, the trial's kind of a big blur.
Yeah, fair enough. What was it like, because you were one of the, you were asking the questions to, what was her name? The U of M scientist, right? Perry?
Yeah.
Cheryl
Perry.
Yeah. So was that, like, what was that like to be the one actually physically asking the questions in that courtroom with that pressure? And?
It's kind of anticlimactic.
Okay.
I mean, I actually think that, like, cases are won or lost in the trenches before you get into the courtroom.
Interesting. Okay. Right. Okay, exactly. And did you know then that this case, it wasn't won, I guess, because they settled, but did you have the idea going into the trial then that you were going to be successful? However you would define success?
Yeah, so different attorneys, like, think about that differently. Like, Mike is like a, what do you call it when you just envision it? Like, you manifest it. Like, that's what he does. I just, like, go day to day, like, what do I got to do today?
Okay.
So I don't think about the long term so much.
Okay. And then, how did you feel about the outcome of the trial when it finally happened?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was like, we didn't know it was going to settle. It was the last day, Thursday, the tobacco companies did their closing arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Friday morning, Mike was going to give his closing arguments, and then it was going to go to the jury.
Okay.
We knew there were settlement discussions going on, but we were focused on trial.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked down from the St. Paul Hotel to the courtroom that morning, thinking we were going to do closing arguments. And then when we got to our war room, we got a call that the case was settled. So, again, you go from, being in the war zone to the case is done.
Okay.
At that point, it's hard to absorb it all.
Do you wish that it had gone to the jury?
Not really, because it would be hard to imagine, like, getting a better result. So
exactly.
We might still be appealing it today, so... it's nice to have a clean ending where you get, pretty much what you were after.
Exactly. And then I'm curious as well, almost, about, the impact that the lawsuit had on you personally. Like, I'm curious about your, how were you doing? Were you okay? Like,
I was tired.
Yeah, okay.
It probably took a couple years to, recover. I went and did a fellowship with the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, so that was part of my recovery period. So they were, and this goes also to the impact of our case.
Yes.
So they were, you know, it's a UN agency. They have treaty-making authority, but mm-hmm. they'd never used it, and they were going to use it to do essentially a treaty of, they call the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control.
Okay.
That would regulate tobacco worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because when the industry is like looking at some countries that are less resourced than the United States, their mm-hmm. tobacco control laws are not necessarily as stringent in ours, and ours aren't that great either.
Yeah.
But at least to establish like a backdrop of tobacco regulation. So, so I went there and worked on their tobacco control for about a year.
Okay.
Which was a nice way to decompress because it was doing good work, but it wasn't litigation.
Exactly. Okay.
And then I also spent a few months. I guess it was before I went to WHO, mm-hmm. working with the Department of Justice lawyers in Washington, so commuting to Washington. They were, when they were in the stage of getting their case, their RICO case ready for trial,
okay.
or ready for filing.
And then, yeah, kind of switching over to impacts then, maybe. Overall, what did this settlement signify for the tobacco control movement?
Yeah, so I think the documents had the biggest impact,
okay.
Which, you know, was our hope all along,
exactly.
to just shine a light on the industry's conduct. So I think, you know, there was a lot of, around the world, I mean, when I was with WHO, I mean, you know, public health, officials and attorneys from countries all around the world mm-hmm. were looking at these documents, and I think it was helping inform their thoughts on tobacco control. All the peer-reviewed literature that Monique and Richard Hurt worked
mm-hmm.
on. I mean, I don't know how many peer-reviewed articles there are in the literature, but just, I think, you know, just just shining a light on industry conduct is a helpful thing.
Absolutely. Do you think the tobacco industry actually changed after the settlement?
Yeah, it changed, but not enough.
Okay.
You know, they did admit causation and addiction after the document. You know, part of the settlement, a big part of the settlement, was all the documents became public. So
mm-hmm.
it was hard for them to keep denying that. So,
exactly.
you know, that was one of the biggest changes.
What were some of the ways that they were able to kind of get out of changing more drastically?
Yeah, so I'm probably not the best person to ask,
sure,
yeah. just because I haven't paid as much attention to it. But
absolutely.
Like, you know, Doug Bonnke, I'm sure, like, talked about that. But,
definitely.
You know, they're an industry with 1,000 lives.
And then some of the settlement money, too. What do you think of the way that it's been spent?
Yeah, so it's obviously disappointing that it wasn't used for the purposes for which it was gained. You know, we were told that you couldn't dedicate the money in the settlement, that it had to go into the general coffers, and then it's up to the legislature. So
yep.
After, what, the first couple of years, they just took the dedicated money and used it for whatever. And the money is still coming in, so, right.
Then, yeah, we kind of talked about making sure that the documents are accessible to the public. What do you make of the depository closing now?
You know, at this point in time, I think it's fine.
Okay.
I think all the documents are online anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I still like handling paper, so, you know, I would rather be in a depository than looking at things online. But after, you know, 25 years, I think it's okay.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of surprising and rewarding that it lasted this long, which was due to the DOJ litigation.
Okay. I think my list of questions is almost done. My last one being, where would you place the trial in your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a singular event.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes it feels like it was yesterday, and sometimes it feels like it was another lifetime. So it just kind of floats out there in its own world.
Did you ever do anything past the trial that got close to that same... I mean, you've done so much, obviously.
Yeah, but, I mean, I knew during the case, during the 4 years, that there was never going to be anything like it. I mean, it was just obvious that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and to, you know, make the most of it and enjoy it. It just felt like it was exactly what I was supposed to be doing in that period of time. And nothing like that. It's just like so many things aligned to make it like the perfect time, the perfect opportunity, the perfect people on the team to be doing it with.
Have I missed anything? I feel like there must be holes somewhere that I'm forgetting about.
Not really.
Okay.
You know, I think your questions are really good.
Okay.
Just one thing that I would like to talk about.
Please.
That's post-trial is, but a result of the trial, is the foundation that was set up with some of the attorney's fees from the case.
So
yes. Now it's called the Cerisi Walburn Foundation.
Mm.
But originally it was the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And so the Robbins law firm took $30 million and endowed this foundation. So it's a separate legal entity.
Okay.
So it's an independent legal entity. We have, you know, our own board of directors right now. Only three of the 8 or 9 people are attorneys. The rest are community people.
Okay.
We've had a focus on making the lives of children and youth in Minnesota better, you know, stemming from one of the focuses of the tobacco case being on marketing to kids. And we've kind of refined our grant giving over the years, but for at least the last 10 years, we're focused on the education inequities in Minnesota.
Okay.
And part of that is trying to inform people that, contrary to what popular belief might be, Minnesota schools are among the worst in the nation for children of color. And then the large part of our giving is helping kids from pre-K up through college. Children of color to have better access to better schools.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Oh, wow, okay. And it's still active?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's how I spend like a large chunk of my time now.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give some of the examples of, I guess, what exactly the work is? Like, yeah, I guess, like, how is the money being used, or how?
So, so one of the things that we've done, this is, like, a minor part of our money, but it has a big impact, we hope. So we've done billboards.
Oh, okay.
We like to think that our philosophy in the foundation is similar to our philosophy in the tobacco litigation, is to go big and bold, you know, and since we're an endowed foundation, we don't have to raise money, so we don't have to worry about what people think.
Okay.
So our first billboards were just these big billboards that said, Minnesota schools worst in the nation for our children of color. And then We've done a few other billboards, but mm-hmm. our most recent ones are, so one of our big focuses on our grants, which I'll talk about in a minute, mm-hmm. is the science of reading, and that we're not teaching kids how to read the right way.
Oh,
and
okay.
so one of our last billboards was Minnesota white kids can't read either, or it's something, or half, or whatever. It was,
okay.
It's on our website, but if you Google the Cerise Walburn Foundation.
Gotcha.
So anyway, that was like, people went crazy over that. They went. So that's one thing, is like trying to call attention to the fact that this state is not what people think it is.
Okay.
For education inequities. But then the bulk of our grant giving, so for pre-K, because mm-hmm. the science is well established that that's one of the most effective ways to spend money is to quality pre-K education.
Yeah.
So we support some pre-K schools, mm-hmm. give scholarships to kids going to pre-K.
Gotcha.
Have supported some think tanks that have been advocating for more pre-K. For K through 12, mm-hmm. we support schools that do a better job of educating brown and black children than the public schools.
Okay.
Well, than Minneapolis public schools.
Sure.
So it might be charter schools, which are public schools.
Okay.
So we support high-performing charter schools and some private schools that are predominantly black and brown children.
Mm-hmm.
And then our most recent endeavor is a college scholarship program for African American men, which is now at St. Thomas.
Okay. Wow, okay. Very cool. What were some of the grants that you were just referring to?
That's
what goes, okay.
So those are the grants. So some of them are, most of the grants are to like schools or
okay.
organizations.
Gotcha, okay.
Some of them are to like the individual scholars for the St. Thomas students.
Mm-hmm.
One of our big recent grants is, I mentioned the literacy issue and the science of reading.
Yeah.
To the Robbinsdale School District, so we're giving them a big 3-year grant to use the most rigorous, up-to-date research on how to teach kids to read in grades 1 through 3 in Robbinsdale.
Okay. And do you think that did the tobacco trial inform this work then? Like, it's kind of streamlined directly from that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, both the money, obviously, but also, trying to make lives better for Minnesota kids.
I think that's all my questions.
Okay, good.
Anything else before we...
I don't think so. You did a good job, so thanks.
Cool, no, you did a good job. Awesome. I will stop just then.